next case is Managed Care Advisory Group versus Cigna et al. You may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kevin Kono for Appellants Epic Systems, Inc., David Garcia, and Neil Manning. Appellants iMedics, Millennium Healthcare Consulting, and Mary Falbo, in the interest of efficiency and because the issues are largely the same, have agreed to give their time to me. I'm going to refer collectively to this group as the reviewers. As to the reviewers, this appeal represents the culmination of years of effort by Appley MKG to take unauthorized discovery from the reviewers in MKG's private arbitration with Cigna. MKG has tried discovery requests in the arbitration, which is unauthorized as to non-parties, subpoenas issued under the guise of federal court authority from the districts of Oregon, California, and Pennsylvania, which are completely unauthorized, and now arbitral summonses served all across the country that violate the FAA's prohibition on pre-hearing discovery from non-parties. In enforcing those summonses, the district court was the first court of which we are aware to authorize nationwide service of process of an arbitral summons. No other court of which we are aware has found it constitutional to compel individuals from thousands of miles away to appear and produce documents in an arbitration, which are broader powers than exist in federal court litigants. And it allowed this nationwide service of process and unauthorized pre-hearing discovery without requiring protection of the non-parties, the reviewers, from the significant expense associated with that requested discovery as current FRCP 45 requires. Those rulings were all legally incorrect, but the district court lacked subject matter jurisdiction to take any of these actions in the first instance. There's no subject matter jurisdiction here over the motion to enforce the arbitral summonses because, first, the FAA does not confer jurisdiction, and second, there's no independent basis for jurisdiction. As to the FAA, this court has already held with respect to sections 10 and 11, which contains nearly identical language to section 7 in the Balton case, that the FAA does not confer jurisdiction. It's a well-established principle. The circuits that have addressed jurisdiction specifically under section 7 also hold that there's no conferral of jurisdiction, and this court should follow its own precedent in Balton and the other circuits to rule on this and find that the FAA does not confer jurisdiction. There's also no other or independent basis for jurisdiction. MKG's sole argument at this stage is that there was retained jurisdiction under the settlement agreement between Cigna and the class members in the closed MDL. But MKG and the reviewers are not parties to the MDL. They're not parties to the settlement agreement. This is a private arbitration between MKG and Cigna. The reviewers, of course, are not parties to the arbitration. There cannot be retained jurisdiction under a settlement agreement in an MDL as to which neither MKG nor the reviewers are parties. So that's the threshold issue here, and it's important because I think MKG talks about the district court retaining jurisdiction over the arbitration. Judge Moreno had nothing to do with the commencement of the arbitration. The settlement agreement does not contain an arbitration provision. The district court did not order arbitration. This is a private agreement between MKG and Cigna that, as MKG said at page 3 of its brief, took this dispute outside of the class action. So there's no subject matter jurisdiction under the settlement agreement over this dispute between two non-parties to the settlement agreement, nor is there any other basis for jurisdiction. Personal jurisdiction is also lacking. We've argued in the briefs that Section 7 does not authorize nationwide service of process. Section 7 refers to service in the manner provided for the service of subpoenas. Our position is that this refers to FRCP 45 as it existed at the time that the FAA was enacted. But even if FRCP 45, as it's currently exists, is what Section 7 is referring to, Nationwide Service of Process is only one step in the personal jurisdiction analysis, and that's the Panama case that sets forth the analytical framework. First, you look to whether there's a federal statute authorizing jurisdiction. So even if we assume, and we dispute this, but even if you assume Nationwide Service of Process, then you have to look at due process considerations. And here we're talking about hailing parties or non-parties to the arbitration, the reviewers here from all over the country to appear and produce documents in Florida. There's no basis for that, and it's important to look at when what Congress did when it authorized Nationwide Service of Process in FRCP 45. Is it authorized Nationwide Service of Process, but it put important due process protections in, and it expressly said in the commentary that these were protections against the burden to non-parties. A non-party who served a subpoena under FRCP 45 can go to its local jurisdiction to seek to dispute the subpoena. A non-party who receives an FRCP 45 subpoena can only be required to appear within 100 miles of service or within the state if there's not significant expense. So these are due process considerations that the district court ignored and that mitigate and show that there's no personal jurisdiction. These reviewers have not purposefully availed themselves of anything in Florida, and there's no personal jurisdiction. Another important aspect, though, if the Section 7 is treated as incorporating or referring to current FRCP 45, then that means the current cost protection provisions of FRCP 45 also must apply. Section 7 says that the enforcement of the attendance of witnesses shall be in the same manner provided by law for securing the attendance of witnesses in courts. Current FRCP 45 requires that first, the party seeking the discovery, and second, the court ordering discovery, protect the non-parties against significant costs. That's a change from former FRCP 45, which made it discretionary, to current FRCP 45, which makes it mandatory. That means there can't be an order enforcing a summons, an arbitral summons against a non-party, without also protecting the non-party against costs. And here, it's undisputed on this record that the costs to EPIC are in the seven figures. So the district court erred in failing to protect the reviewers against those costs. This is also unauthorized discovery. Section 7 allows an arbitral summons only to appear before the arbitrator and to produce documents or bring documents with them before the arbitrator. These arbitral summonses do not require or seek an appearance before the arbitrator. What they seek, and the arbitrator recognized that what MKG is really after here is discovery, and he called what they're seeking in the nature of a discovery event. And then he created this mechanism where he was going to have segmented hearings and video appearance. That's not an appearance before the arbitrator. And then Magistrate Judge O'Sullivan contemplated the exchange of documents to accommodate this video contrivance before the testimony would be taken. That's discovery. Okay. Section 7 in the courts, we have numerous circuits who have addressed this issue, Hay Group by now Justice Alito and the Ninth Circuit recently in CBS, that recognize you can't take pre-hearing discovery. That's a pretty well-established proposition by all of the circuits that have addressed that most recently. Video doesn't solve this problem. And if we look to FRCP 43, by analogy, it doesn't apply. It shows that video doesn't solve the problem. What FRCP 43 says is that the testimony must be taken in trial in open court. And then it adds a provision that says that for good cause and compelling circumstances and with appropriate safeguards, the court may permit testimony in open court by contemporaneous transmission from a different location. Congress knows that when we're talking about being in open court, it means being there in the physical presence to use the Hay Group's court's language. And when Congress contemplates something different, simultaneous transmission from a different location, it recognizes that's not before the court and that special provisions need to be made. If there's any question about the discovery nature of these summonses, we can look to the summons directed to EPIC, which is essentially a 30B6 type mechanism. EPIC is a company, it's not an individual. It can't just appear. That's what 30B6 is for in the federal litigation context, which is a mechanism to get discovery from a company. At trial in a federal court, you can't simply serve a subpoena on a company to show up for trial. So if there's any question about it being unauthorized discovery, I think the summons directed to EPIC answers that. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, Marty Steinberg from Hogan Lovells on behalf of Cigna. We're simply unaware of any class action anywhere where a third party solicits and enters into purported contingent fee agreements, all unauthorized by the district court, then takes the majority of the class action funds for itself and its principals. When this evidence was discovered, the MDL had been closed for many years, but simply because Cigna was in an arbitration where this evidence was discovered doesn't mean that Cigna is barred from presenting this evidence to the district court of the unauthorized use of class funds. We believe there is an abuse of discretion by the court to consider the facts, apply the law, fashion appropriate remedies under the settlement agreement. After all, the undisputed evidence before the court when we made our motion to enforce the settlement agreement was of the $11 million paid pre-arbitration, MCAG took $3.5 million for itself, despite the fact that they had filed an affidavit in the district court stating that all $11 million went to the class. That's number one. Number two, of the $14 million paid by Cigna to MCAG during the arbitration, starting in 2005, for 13 years, MCAG's own records show that not one penny has ever been distributed to the class members. MCAG not only concealed it from the class members, but on its own website, they acted as if Cigna was not paying, stating that they were still fighting Cigna and, quote, are cautiously optimistic there would be positive movement in the future. At the time they stated that, Cigna had already paid $22 million, but that's what they told the class members. Their own records show that since 2005, 75% of the class funds have been taken by MCAG for its own use, 27% remain with them, and not one dime has been paid to the class. And all of this was done without any notice to or approval by the district court. And in addition to that, in the 13 years they've held the class action funds and interest has been accumulated, they say, to the tune of $1.6 million, they've not preserved that interest or paid that interest to class members. So without knowing any more, because we still, to this day, do not have an accounting of what MCAG did with these funds, $3.5 million, $10 million, $1.6 million, at least $15.1 million of the $25 million in class funds has been taken by MCAG. And according to the records before the court at the time we filed our motion, they claim they took it for $2.6 million for their own retention fee. They claim that in addition to the retention fee, they paid $1.4 million to their unidentified partners. They claim that they paid $4.4 million during the arbitration for attorney's fees in addition to the over $55 million that was separately approved by the district court for the payment of class counsel. They claim...
Let me just ask you a question about what has occurred. Tell me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that there was an accounting initiated in the arbitration with respect to the funds paid through the arbitration. Would you tell me what happened with that?
Yes, Your Honor. We asked for an accounting in August of 2016. The arbitrator granted it sometime later. MCAG responded to it, I believe, in April of 2017, after the district court held its hearing on our motion to enforce. And as you will see in the record, there's an affidavit from an expert accountant who said they didn't comply, they didn't provide actual bank records, they redacted most of the records, they didn't provide any wire transfer, any canceled check, they didn't provide any document that shows who exactly got this money. So to this day, there's been no accounting of the funds that MCAG got. All we have in the record here, Your Honor, are their self-made charts of what they said they did with the money, which are bad enough. But we don't have the actual records required by an accounting.
Is the arbitrator taking any further action with respect to that? Is there anything pending?
Yes, there is. It's not in this record, but the arbitrator's taking further action with respect to the accounting.
So are you asking for the district court to review the other funds that were paid outside of the arbitration or both?
We're asking the district court to review the pre-arbitration funds that were taken by MCAG and the post-arbitration funds taken by MCAG. Remember, the arbitrator's duty is to determine the compensability of Category 2 claims, and that's been going on for quite some time. As each claim has been approved by the arbitrator, Cigna's paid it, and MCAG's received it, but it's not been distributed. What we're asking the district court to do, what we asked the district court to do, was to take a look at the money the arbitrator had already approved. We didn't present any objection, or we didn't contest anything the arbitrator did. And that's why the order on his face is incorrect. The order said, the arbitrator shall arbitrate the claims in a manner he sees fit. We didn't present any issue to the district court challenging the arbitrator's decision on any claim. What we were asking the district court to do was to say, as to the claims that have already been approved by the arbitrator and paid by Cigna, but misused by MCAG, Judge, you need to take some action. You need to void their contracts because you didn't approve them in advance. You need to rule against them because they solicited class members in a certified class without your approval. You need to take some action about the money that never got to the class members in terms of restitution, disgorgement, sanctions. You need to take some action about the false affidavit that was filed in front of you. That's what we were asking the district court to do, which has nothing at all to do with the arbitration. The arbitration is still proceeding. And merely because we've asked for a similar accounting in both jurisdictions doesn't matter. Judge Moreno is very, very adept at dealing with other judicial bodies and MDLs, coordinating discovery. We're not asking for two separate accountings. We're asking for one full accounting. But we're also asking the district court to take action that only he can take in enforcing the settlement agreement. We're not interfering with the arbitrator in any way. The arbitrator is still adjudicating claims. In addition to the monies I've already mentioned, MCAG paid over $1.7 million to its four principals. They also took additional cost. So what was before the district court at the time is he knew we paid $25 million. He knew that at least 15.1 of that $1 million of that $25 million had been taken by MCAG. He knew that none of the interest on the funds had ever been accumulated or paid to the class members. He knew they didn't account or disclose to the district court for any of these actions. In fact, their records disclosed, and we presented to the district court, that they commingled all of these funds into 51 of their own operating accounts without approval from anybody. So they have no records of those operating accounts, essentially, that we've seen, and they've misled the class members to believe that Cigna wasn't paying this money after we had already paid the money. So these disturbing facts really are a roadmap for misappropriation of class funds. And MCAD can't deny these facts because they come from their own records. That's where they come from. They fought tooth and nail to keep them private and confidential, and today we still don't have records that show who actually got this money. We presented this both to Judge O'Sullivan and Judge Moreno. Now, they deferred to the arbitrator, but as you can see, the arbitrator's deciding claims. Only the district court can fashion remedies to protect these funds. When a service provider begins to take funds that were intended for the class, that creates a conflict that only the district court can resolve. And if you look at the structure of the settlement, which is over 100 pages, you will see the structure of the settlement is that no service provider fees or costs were to come from the monies intended for the class. None. The attorney's fees were paid separately, up to $55 million. The administrative fees were paid separately by Cigna. No service provider fees under the structure of that class action settlement were going to be paid out of the funds of the class members. And yet MCAG took not only their fees, they claim their fees, but they took all of this money for themselves and others who weren't class members out of the class funds without approval. And that's what we asked the district court judge to address. Now, we don't have any explanation about what the district court judge was thinking at the time, because he merely said, I'm letting the arbitrator arbitrate the claims as he sees fit, which we never complained about and is still going on to this day. But as the case law clearly says, the In Re Corrugated Container case and the Skelton versus GM case and other cases, a district court's job is to see that the class settlement is fully implemented and completed until the money is distributed to class members.
You're over your time. We understand your argument. Thank you.
I'll reserve my right. Thank you.
Good morning. Andrew Selesnik for Appellee Managed Care Advisory Group. May it please the court. Neither of the appellants addressed the court's initial question, which was, is this even appealable, what the district court ordered? We would urge the court to affirm the district court's order. These orders are not appealable. They are not final. There is still more work to be done. And one only needs to look at the history of this 13-year arbitration to recognize that the district court has been involved multiple times.
Why aren't they final and appealable as to the reviewers? Separate these out if we could.
They are not final and reviewable as to the reviewers because the reviewers were integrally involved in the arbitration itself. So they voluntarily agreed to be part of this arbitration.
No, not this arbitration.
This arbitration. The arbitration that is between Managed Care Advisory Group and Cigna, they voluntarily agreed to be part of it. They were paid tens of millions of dollars to participate in the arbitration, to process claims, to adjudicate claims, to review the claims, render decisions. The record before you shows that they followed the arbitrator's orders. They inquired to the arbitrator if they had questions. They weren't just some third party who happenstance might have some information. They were an integral part of the entire arbitration, and they were paid handsomely for that work. When it came time now to account for the multiple claims processings, these claims were processed not once, not twice, but three times, because the arbitrator continually found that there were errors in the processing, either by Cigna or the reviewers or both. They are part of this arbitration. While they might argue we're really not part of it, They are. They're an integral part of the whole thing, which is why the arbitrator issued summons for them to come to a hearing and account for their actions. That was the purpose.
In doing that, at least one argues that it will be an expense of up to over $1 million, correct? And so what is the remedy that the reviewer has if you're incorrect? Ultimately, you're incorrect. The reviewer has gone through this process, producing documents not subject to a properly issued subpoena. They do all that, and what's their remedy?
Well, in the district court, the reviewers did not make any showing or present any evidence whatsoever as to the cost associated with the compliance. There's no evidence of it. Under Section 7, if they wanted costs, they should have asked for the costs. But instead, they put all their eggs in one basket, which was we have qualified immunity, we have deliberative privilege, we have all sorts of other things, you don't have jurisdiction, all sorts of other arguments. But they didn't make the cost argument. There's nothing in the record before you that shows that they made that cost argument. Therefore, it's our position that they've waived that cost argument. They can come back later now and say, well, we'd really like to do it. Now, the arbitrator did indicate that he would hear their cost issues at some point. But our position is that while that's the arbitrator's position, the reality is that under Section 7, if the district court is the one that's supposed to be looking at the cost issue, then the reviewers have waived it because they did not present any evidence to the district court about this $1 million and what would it entail. It's an extraordinary sum to produce documents, especially when you take out all of the claims that are involved, and we're only seeking very limited emails and other process-related documents, which the arbitrator had already issued. He'd already looked at the requests, he narrowed them, allowed them to be issued.
How many documents would that entail?
It's hard to say.
Make your best guess.
I'm going to say it's going to be less than 10,000. In this day and age, it's a relatively small sum. And in particular, one of the reviewers says that they've produced all the documents already, so there's zero issues associated with that, if that's in fact accurate. As to Epic, I believe, also has an e-discovery arm to the company, so one would presume that they would be able to do it fairly efficiently and quickly. So the idea that this was $1 million we have no basis. We attempted in the underlying arbitration to meet and confer with Epic over it, and they refused to give us the basis how they came up with their $1 million.
What about the 30B6 argument that they've raised?
Under the 30B6, there's nothing in the FAA that says that the manner in which the arbitrator decides that someone should appear. I should say it differently. The FAA does not restrict the arbitrator from determining the manner in which the arbitration should proceed. So in this particular case, he agreed with Managed Care Advisory Group that having a person or persons appear with certain knowledge, that was the most appropriate way for the final hearing to proceed. So there's nothing, and there's no case that they cite otherwise that says that an arbitrator cannot have a summon a 30B6 representative. And there's a practical application too, because under that theory, any time that there's a third-party subpoena that's issued under the FAA that's appropriate, corporations, they wouldn't have to comply. If the party doesn't know, for example, Managed Care Advisory Group doesn't know the names of some of the people who worked on this particular project, what their involvements were, no, we have no idea. And under the FAA, we're not permitted to conduct any discovery, and indeed, this is not discovery. This is a fair remedy. In the future, if the court holds otherwise, then corporations where plaintiffs or otherwise were looking for particular witnesses, they'd have no basis for obtaining those witnesses. They wouldn't know how to get them.
Would you agree that the motion to enforce the summonses should have been filed as a separate case in the district court rather than in the MDL proceeding?
We don't agree. We believe that the district court correctly presumed that it had ancillary jurisdiction based on the underlying action. So in the underlying action, Managed Care Advisory Group, through one of its clients, Texas Children's Pediatric Associates, filed a motion to enforce the settlement agreement. That motion was fully briefed but not heard, and the parties agreed to go to private arbitration. Later on, the arbitrator unfortunately passed away. The parties, that is Cigna and Managed Care Advisory Group, they went to Judge Moreno and they asked him to appoint an arbitrator, and he did. At that point, there was no argument that the Judge Moreno did not have jurisdiction to hear it. And indeed, if that's the argument, then Judge Moreno's previous order appointing the arbitrator would also be void. That is, he did not have jurisdiction then to appoint the arbitrator, but he has jurisdiction now. It creates a real problem.
I question whether he had jurisdiction at all, quite frankly, under 1407, because after MDL is completed, the case would go back to the original court that had sent the case to the MDL. So why shouldn't these matters be resolved in those jurisdictions?
In this particular case, it went back to multiple jurisdictions. But this became a private dispute before all the cases were sent back. And so this case doesn't involve a particular claim for a particular state. It is nationwide. It's 20,000 physicians. It's 25 states. And so I think the practical reality of it. In addition, if we had filed a separate action, which we would maybe be back here anyways, but certainly I think we would have had to notify the court that Judge Moreno previously had some involvement in it. So we're sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place. And certainly under the ancillary jurisdiction that the court believed that it had, that anything relating to the settlement administration, and given the unique facts of this particular case, I think the court correctly concluded this all involves the settlement administration. You've been here before, therefore I'm gonna hear it.
I may be wrong on this, but I believe most of the cases that you cite on ancillary jurisdiction do not involve MDL proceedings. Is that
fair? Correct? Correct. This is an unusual history with an unusual length. Definitely. I want to spend a few minutes discussing the arguments that were made here today by the Reviewers Council and by Cigna as well. With regard to the reviewers, their number one point was that this is discovery. The record does not support that. The arbitrator specifically rejected the idea that discovery could be had on the third parties and said that instead it would be done at a hearing. The district court agreed with the arbitrator, Magistrate O'Sullivan, and Judge Moreno affirmed that. So that's three different people who said this is not discovery. The only one saying that it's discovery are the reviewers. Reviewers also state that this would be extremely burdensome for them. Well, the arbitrator took that into account, and that the arbitrator is going to stay here in Miami, and the reviewers would appear in their home districts. There's no burden associated with that, other than to call and come and answer questions and discuss the policies and procedures and how they adjudicate claims for which they were paid voluntarily. They were involved in it, for which they were paid millions and millions of dollars. So there's no burden associated with it. In terms of personal jurisdiction, it's nationwide service. We believe that their interpretation of the FAA is unduly restrictive. The FAA says that it's service under Rule 45. It did not point a specific time period in the 1940s or when the FAA was first instituted. Regardless, at the time we served it, it was pursuant to FRCP 45, and that's the appropriate standard. With regards to Cigna's claims, the arguments that Cigna made today are the same arguments that Cigna made to the district court. It's the same arguments that were rejected by both the magistrate and by Judge Moreno. There's nothing new associated with it. And while we disagree with their characterizations, those issues are being dealt, at least currently right now, in front of the arbitrator. Now, it's our position that this arbitration was very narrow, and the only issue is the compensability of Category 2 claims, not what MCAG did with money that was paid and how it dispersed that money. But regardless, that's what the arbitrator is doing. What Cigna wants to do is subject Managed Care Advisory Group to two competing accountings. There's nothing different about what they want. They want to know where the money went and how it was spent. Now, it's our position that it's irrelevant anyways, but the district court correctly concluded that the arbitrator is handling it for right now, and that would be sufficient for what they want to do.
The accounting that's being handled by the arbitrator, is that only with respect to the Category 2 claims?
Correct. Regardless, Cigna did not meet its burden in the underlying action. All of the comments that are made today, what you have in front of the record, and indeed the additional information that Cigna tried to supplement, but that this court struck, all of that was in front of Magistrate O'Sullivan and in front of Judge Moreno. And they simply rejected it. There's nothing unusual about it. We understand that they're upset about it, but that doesn't mean that it's wrong. And they provide no law or no contrary facts that would indicate otherwise. Unless Your Honor's have any...
Is Cigna entitled to ask for an accounting on the Class 1 funds that were paid?
On the Category A and Category 1 funds?
Why shouldn't it be able to ask for that accounting now?
I don't think they would be entitled to ever ask for that accounting in the first place. I don't think they have standing to ask for the accounting. Their role was to pay money, and they paid the money. What happened after that money?
What you did with it is not their concern, correct?
What they did, what?
You paid zero to the claimants, not their concern. That's your position.
Correct. It would be the claimants. Now, the claimants, if they have an issue with it, they can certainly come after.
How would they know? How would they know whether, has there been any information provided that you gave notice to any of these claimants that the monies were received?
In part of this record, it's not there, but outside of the record, there was testimony at hearing that interested parties were given information, stakeholders were informed on a regular basis, medical societies, steering committees, that sort of thing.
Is there any information in the record that a penny was paid to any of these claimants?
Yes.
In the record, there is information of that.
In the record...
Cigna says y'all are a bunch of crooks.
Yes.
That you've taken this money that should have been paid to claimants.
Yes.
You say you're not entitled to see this. So my question is there anything that the district court had in the record that would refute their allegation that you haven't paid any of the money?
Yes. I mean, there's been evidence presented in, I think, both proceedings that as to Category A and Category 1, MCAG took its service fee, which it is entitled to do, and then paid the rest of the money to its clients.
And how much does the record indicate how much does the record indicate was paid?
I think it's approximately $7.5 million, something in that range.
Of how much?
I think that there was about $11 million paid in Category A and Category 1 claims. And $3.5 million of that, I think, believe was kept by MCAG and its partners, and the additional amounts were dispersed to the clients. As it relates to Category 2 claims, the monies have not been dispersed to the clients. And the reason for that is that I'm trying to be careful to stay within the record, although the record is quite...
And I'm not really concerned about what the reason is. I'm just... concerned about the numbers and what you admit, what you don't admit.
Understood.
Record.
Right.
How much of the Category 2 claim monies do you admit were received?
Approximately $14.5 million.
And of that amount, how much was paid to claimants, according to the record?
None.
Zero.
None thus far. Correct.
So the total of $25.5 million, $3.5 million has been dispersed to clients. Is that
correct? And to that point, Your Honor, it is MCAG's position. Co-counsel has reminded me that there was no formal evidence. There were questions that were asked, but there were no, in the underlying proceeding, there were not documents that were provided with this information. In the arbitration, there were plenty of documents, although not to Cigna's satisfaction. The arbitrator is currently... undertaking
your statement to this court is that of the amounts of monies that were paid, About 14% have been distributed to claimants.
Thus far. And the reason I say thus far is that according to the record, there are still, I believe, four and a half million as of the time of these particular proceedings that was being retained pending the ultimate outcome of the arbitration, at which point MCAG would make decisions about how to disperse the funds that are remaining.
You made an argument regarding standing. Have you made that argument to the district court?
In terms of Cigna's response?
Cigna's standing, right, to raise these issues.
We have argued that Cigna does not have, that Cigna's arguments regarding there was a breach of fiduciary duty, that there was no case law that supports it. So they don't have standing to make the argument. Whether we use those exact words that they have no standing, I could not say, but I can say that we forcefully disagree with them that they have any standing. In the arbitration, we have most certainly argued that they have no standing to make the arguments that is that once they pay the money, especially particularly in the private arbitration, that what managed care does with that money, they have no standing as to argue it should be paid in a certain manner or not. And there is an important point here, which is Cigna comes up here and pretends that they have no idea who MCAG is. They know who MCAG is. They knew it in 2005 when MCAG submitted the majority of the claims in the on behalf of the class members. They knew it when they entered into this private arbitration agreement. They knew exactly who MCAG was. They knew exactly what MCAG did. To now argue some 13 years later that, surprise, MCAG wants to be paid its service fees is puzzling to us, because they know exactly who MCAG was, who they were representing, and what they were advocating.
Well, again, I want to get back to this question I asked you earlier. If this additional money that's available is paid, all of it's paid, and you don't hold anything back, the most that you could pay these claimants would be about 32%, according to my math.
Understood.
So you're saying who we are. You're a service company that would be retaining 68% of settlement funds.
That's not entirely accurate. And again, I'm outside the record, so I want to be permitted to respond, because there was evidence in the arbitration, and the arbitrator has made rulings already as to how those funds were distributed and what sources that he believes were appropriate and not appropriate. So I'm constrained by what's in the record, unless Your Honor wants to hear more. But this is, again, the point where this sort of illustrates our point, which is the arbitration is ongoing. The arbitrator is dealing with a multitude of issues, some of which we agree with, some of which Cigna agrees with, some of which we both disagree. You know, we're here to get a summons enforced in order to get to a final decision some 13 years after this arbitration started. That's all we're trying to do, nothing more and nothing less. And while these arguments may sound they're interesting to those, this case has a long and tortured history, and at some point either the case will settle and resolve, or perhaps we'll be back in front of Judge Moreno with either side asking that to be challenged. But that's when the case is entirely over. And that's all the more reason that the summons should be enforced, so that we can move on with the case. Because what you're dealing right now with is a limited record on these particular issues. And while Cigna has raised a whole host, they've raised it in front of the district court as well, and the district court has concluded that let the arbitrator do what the arbitrator is going to do, and maybe I'll see you back here, and maybe I won't. But you've all chosen to be in arbitration. That's where you need to be. If there are no further questions, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Counsel for MCAG represents that and argues that the reviewers have waived the argument with respect to costs, and I want to address that first, because the record is very, very clear that that's not the case. At Joint Appendix 1033, there's the declaration of Michael O'Connor in opposition to the motion to enforce the arbitral summonses, the detail, the work that would go in to EPIC, and connection with these costs after reviewing the requested documents provides great detail about what would be necessary, the hourly breakdown, and the total cost. These are arguments that were raised in the briefing before the district court in the opposition to the motion to enforce at Joint Appendix 882 and 83. It was raised again in connection with the objections to the magistrate's ruling, Joint Appendix 1373, and then on reply at Joint Appendix 1637. There is simply no question that these issues were raised, preserved, and specific evidence in the record exists as to the costs that EPIC is talking about. The court asked a question about appellate jurisdiction with respect to the reviewers, and the response from MCAG was the argument that the reviewers have voluntarily participated in the arbitration. Well, the reviewers are vendors that were hired to provide services. That's what they do. We dispute the characterization of the involvement in the arbitration, but it's frankly irrelevant to the question of appellate jurisdiction. What the reviewers did or didn't do in the arbitration has nothing to do with the finality analysis, which is a functional test that the court looks at. Is there anything left to do in the district court? Now, there's nothing left to do in the closed MDL in which MCAG incorrectly and improperly filed their motion to enforce the summons. MDL is closed. Judge Moreno ruled on all pending motions, and for good measure in his omnibus order said any and all other pending motions are denied as moot. There is nothing left to do in the MDL. Now, had they properly filed a separate action, then it would be even clearer. It's a standalone independent proceeding where the party seeking to enforce the summons brings before the proper district court that has power to hear that motion. And then once the motion to enforce the summons is ruled on, there's nothing left. And that's why this court, in the parallel context of foreign subpoenas and administrative subpoenas, have found those cases to produce final rulings that are subject to appeal. So too with Section 7, and the only circuits that have addressed Section 7 specifically, similarly, have found that those are final and appealable rulings. So I think there's no question there of this court's appellate jurisdiction. There was a question about burden, and counsel for MCAG, I think, conflates the analysis of the burden of compliance with what the proper focus is the district court's power to exercise its authority over the people, over the reviewers in the first instance. It shouldn't be forgotten that the reviewers have had to come to the Southern District of Florida, from Pennsylvania and Oregon and California to fight the arbitral summons. Having an appearance by video doesn't solve that. Okay? That's the burden in the first instance, and that's what FRCP 45 protects federal court litigants against by allowing litigants or non-parties who are subpoenaed to appear in their local jurisdiction to fight summonses. There was an argument about the appearance to have an arbitrator appointed under Section 5, and that somehow creates jurisdiction, or that it's inconsistent, and it's not. First of all, the dispute here with respect to the reviewers is between MCAG and the reviewers, and those are the parties that the court has to focus on when assessing subject matter jurisdiction over the motion to enforce summonses. There's this was likely a separate jurisdictional basis as between MCAG and Cigna with respect to Section 5. I don't know if that was argued or not, but that doesn't carry over to this different dispute between different parties. So the Section 5 motion to appoint the arbitrator is not relevant. And then there were questions about the closed MDL. And I think it's important to note that, again, Judge Moreno didn't have anything to do with commencing the arbitration. He clearly became aware of it when there was the motion to appoint the arbitrator, but he closed the MDL after that, knowing that there was this arbitration out there. So if there's any question about the effect of the closed MDL in light of the arbitration, I think that answers it. For those reasons and the reasons in our brief, we'd ask that the order of the district court be reversed as to the reviewers. Thank you.
May it please the court. First, I think there's some statements about what's in the record that should be corrected. Counsel said that all issues are being dealt with by the arbitrator that were before the judge on the motion of force. That's incorrect. MCAG's position, in fact, in their briefs before this court, is that the arbitrator has no authority to look at their prior misconduct. What the arbitrator is looking at is whether MCAG, based on its acts, can continue to represent class members in the arbitration, period. That's what the arbitrator is looking at. And by the way, there has been no accounting. This court's issued a ruling in Zaki. It knows exactly what an accounting is. We have gotten no contemporaneous records from MCAG about exactly where this money went. Counsel also said that all of the facts were in front of Magistrate O'Sullivan and Judge Marino that this court struck in the supplemental authority. That's not correct. The supplemental authority that this court struck were the contents of a hearing that took place after both Judge O'Sullivan and Judge Marino ruled. There's still ample evidence in the record that there was a misuse of funds, but that statement is incorrect. As to the question asked about whether class members know what is going on, I repeat what was on MCAG's website. They were struggling to get money from Cigna when we had already paid $22 million, but there is no evidence in this record that a class member has been given notice that Cigna paid $25 million, much less that MCAG misused the $25 million.
Why does Cigna have standing to raise this issue?
I'm sorry?
Why does Cigna have standing to raise this issue on behalf of the class members?
Cigna, well, we're not raising it on behalf of the class members. Cigna is a party to a settlement agreement. That settlement agreement was a long involved 100-page settlement agreement insisted upon by class counsel who did represent the class members. And in that agreement, Cigna agreed to over $400 million of non-monetary and monetary benefits. Why? These are doctors in our network. These are essentially our customers. We needed to get those benefits to those doctors to ameliorate any problem that was resulted from the claim that we hadn't paid claims adequately. There is no one else who has standing. Certainly MCAG doesn't have standing. They weren't a party to the settlement agreement. We were a party to the settlement agreement. And that bargain that we struck, that those benefits would go to those doctors, only a district court can enforce that bargain. And we bargained for that hard because those doctors are in our network and we wanted to make sure they got the benefit of the bargain. And you'll notice we haven't asked for any of the money back. All Cigna's asked for is that the money gets to the class members that it was supposed to get to under the settlement agreement. Counsel also said there were no documents in the record. That, again, is not correct. What was presented to Judge Marino were MCAG self-created charts where they said they took the substantial majority of this money. We still don't have the actual records, but those were their admissions in charts in front of the judge. Now, the other thing I think is important to note is we cited a number of claims processor cases to the court, starting with the Jack Fawcett case all the way through 2018. And in those claims processor cases, those courts stood for the proposition that all of us learned in law school. In a class action, you can't solicit the class unless it's approved by the court. In a class action, you can't enter into a contingent fee arrangement with class members unless it's approved by the court.
Does it make a difference that it's a third party as opposed to an attorney?
No. They are a holder of class funds. If you look at the arbitration agreement itself, it says the arbitrator is deciding the compensability of Category 2 claims under the settlement agreement, under the terms of the settlement agreement. These are class funds. There's no mistake about that. And certainly you can't take class funds without the approval of the court. So, Your Honor, we would be in the ironic position if the court does not enforce the settlement agreement, where a third party can enforce the settlement agreement in a discovery matter, but a party to the arbitration agreement can't enforce it to protect the class action funds. Thank you.